Commonwealth, Mr. Orguera, and Mr. Uberman. Mr. Orguera, you need any time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, if I could reserve 4 minutes, please. Just before I begin, the court has asked us to be prepared to address an issue, and I have, to that end, just prepared a list of citations for cases I wish to quote. Could I give it to the court just to make it easy?
You hand it to the clerk there.
Yes, sir.
And did you get a copy of that, Mr. Uberman?
Yes, Your Honor. I've already given him.
I guess our first question is, it appears that the only person in the courtroom that actually read the criminal statute is the defendant.
It does, Your Honor.
He files a motion while represented by counsel at the last second where he raises the issue you want us to consider. And we're, I guess, just wondering how that alerts the trial court and gives it the opportunity to take the first pass at the problem.
Well, to answer that general question, I would argue that if the trial court had never acted upon it, then perhaps it does not. But the trial court very specifically took it upon itself to review the motion and entered an order finding that it had, in fact, reviewed and was denying that motion. Without that, I think we'd be in a wholly separate place. But since the trial court has, through its orders, and a court speaks through its orders, said, I've reviewed this and I've denied it, I think that we can't go back and question whether he did it properly or whether he took enough of a shot at it. The court has told us through its orders that it did, and I think that's what's required. For the issue to be raised, the defendant did it in such a manner where he also served the Commonwealth, so they had an opportunity to object, and the judge, through its order, said this has been considered and denied.
He also sent it to his own lawyer, didn't he?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
He sent it to his lawyer, too. Did he not?
I do not know. To be honest, I did not represent him in the trial portion, and I cannot speak to whether he did or not.
I know you were at trial counsel, but it seems to be that he was represented by counsel throughout the entire time it was in the trial court. He was never pro se, right?
I think that was he technically represented by counsel? I agree. I think there are a number of reasons why that does not necessarily matter in this case. The first is I would argue that issue has been made moot because the statute does contain a section that says unless promptly counsel comes in and signs it, promptly after being made aware of it. We would argue that the notice from the court was the first time that we were made aware of the issue that it had not been signed, and as I filed the motion before this court almost immediately, I attempted to do so with the clerk. I was denied. I filed in this court, and then subsequently I also filed a same copy with this court.
And we know you tried to immediately do it when it came to your attention, but, this is, you were represented in the trial, but this is many, many months later, and it's now in a different court. So how can that be said to satisfy the statute when it's on in a totally different court on appeal, and I understand they didn't allow you to actually sign
yes.
the actual.
We would argue that the statute does not require it be done with any particular time frame as regards the process of the case. It only says promptly after being brought to its attention. And I would argue that in this case, certainly promptly does not have a specific definition, but the actions of counsel in this case were prompt.
Are you talking about the rule?
Statute 8.01-271.1 contains a section that says it shall be stricken unless promptly signed after it has been brought to the attention of counsel.
But Rule 15A, which was made effective August 1st of 2017, which is after the trial court lost jurisdiction, is the rule that deals with curing signature defects.
Well, I understand that, but I think that since this is a criminal procedure, that the defendant has to be given, for due process reasons, the most expansive benefit possible, and I think that would be contained within the statute. And so that would be our argument as to that it has been remedied. Additionally, though, however, I think there are a number of other reasons that 8.01, 271.1 doesn't apply in this case. First of all, would be precedent. We would argue that the case that there are already been cases before this court that have dealt with this exact issue. McGee versus Commonwealth, which is on the list of citations that I've given you, specifically, it was a case where the defendant filed a motion to set aside a verdict, although he had been represented all at the time by counsel. He filed on his own. And the court specifically found that was good. That was enough to preserve the issue, and this court ruled on the merits. Additionally, in Chilton v. Commonwealth, which is was an unpublished opinion, the court reached the same conclusion. It specifically mentioned that the Commonwealth was arguing that, well, this is no good because it wasn't signed by his attorney, and the court came to the same conclusion as it did in McGee and said, no, this is enough, and it argued that it needed to be determined on the merits. So we have two cases before this court, one published and one not, where there has been a represented person who had filed his own motion and that the courts found it was good. Additionally, we would argue two other cases.
Would you agree that generally that's not allowed? You have numerous federal cases as well as cases from most jurisdictions that indicate that if a party signs his own pleading while he's represented by counsel. You can't have hybrid representation.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue, and this is under a civil procedure statute, and I think in a civil case that's no question absolutely. But here, a defendant has due process rights which civil litigants don't, and I think that's what makes the difference. And specifically also, in LaCara v. Commonwealth, which is a published case, and Velazquez...
I'll say the name of that one again.
LaCara v. Commonwealth and Velazquez both involve cases where the defendant was represented by counsel during the trial and afterwards filed their own notice of appeal. And in both cases, the court found that was acceptable.
We've seen more of that where, sometimes counsel, there's a change in counsel at the trial level and perhaps counsel hasn't been timely appointed for the appeal and the other appointment has expired. And we see quite a bit of pro se notices of appeal, and we've accepted those.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that 801-271.2 just says, includes any other paper. A notice of an appeal is an other paper, we would argue in that case. So if it's all right for notices of appeal, and specifically as...
But the reason we've usually accepted it is because counsel may not... There may be a break in representation there.
Well, I don't know that that's always the case. In fact, I forget if it was LaCara or Velazquez, they specifically talk about how the defendant, there hasn't been a change in counsel, the defendant is complaining about counsel and asking for new counsel, which is very similar to the motion that Mr. McGinnis filed complaining about counsel. So I don't really think that it's in a different place significantly. Additionally to that, we would argue that the issue in this case was not timely raised. We would cite Webb v. Commonwealth. Not Webb v. Commonwealth, it's Webb v. The Social Services. And in that case, which was an unpublished case, this court held that although the initial pleading was not signed by an attorney, the issue was raised for the first time on appeal, and therefore that was too late. So the issue was not timely preserved. As in this case, it was not raised on brief, it was not raised at the trial court, so we would argue, as in Webb, the issue was not raised in a timely fashion. The other case I think that is...
It's a little hard to raise this at trial, wouldn't it? Because this was filed, depending on how you count, I mean, Judge Burnett's order has December 28th date on it, but it seems he signed it on the 29th. At least that's what it looks like, the signature that he put down. And then, so even if he signed it on the 29th, it wasn't filed till the 20th day, and he ruled on the 21st. It would be rather hard to raise it at trial.
Well, I understand, but not at trial, but at the moment it was done, and since the Commonwealth received service, and it would have been probably a week before they received Judge Burnett's order, in that time they did nothing. And I think the larger issue is that it was not raised on brief as well. In Commonwealth versus Dubois, as Your Honor has wrote, in that case, this court found that it was, the lack of a signature was fatal. But in that case, there are two things going on. One, that issue was raised on brief by the Commonwealth, by the defendant, which I would argue is the proper time to argue about a notice of appeal being properly filed. Additionally, in that case, we're talking about a Commonwealth appeal as opposed to a defendant's appeal, because the Commonwealth has very more specific rules. And also, again, the Commonwealth does not have due process rights that the client does. So I would argue that Dubois is not on point, except for the fact that, again, the issue was raised in a timely fashion because it was raised on brief. In this, as wasn't the case in, in Webb, raised on brief, not in the trial court, or not when the issue arose, let me put it in a better way. In this case, we have neither of those, so it's an even worse case.
Gary, you're well into your time, and we want to hear from you on the merits as well. I'm going to extend the time slightly because we have asked you to address something you weren't prepared for, but I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about the merits of the appeal, too.
Your Honor, I think that from a plain reading of the two most important cases, Sylvester and Bray, that it has been the judgment of a panel of this court that, you know, the statute is not violated by a past debt. And I think that any sort of expansion of the statute would require either this court sitting in banc or the Supreme Court to overrule that. I think the idea that kind of, you know, unifies all of these cases is that the statute is basically trying to protect against my giving you a check and you giving me something in return. Okay.
Let me ask you, you talked a little bit about, you sort of conceded that if you're checking out of a hotel and you pay your bill, even though you're out of the room, but you're checking out, that's not a past debt, because it's so close in time, I suppose. But here, not the third check, but the first two, dated April 18th and April 20th, were dated when this thing was going on. People were still in their rooms. People were still getting fed at the hotel. So why is that a past debt?
Well, I won't be certain, because on the statement of accounts for the first and the second check, there were so many numerous charges. I would begin by saying certainly some of the people that they gave rooms to had been checked out for days by the time the check had done. So I would argue that at least in partial it's payment for a past debt. And with the others, I think everyone was checked out, or that the food had been all consumed by the time that the check had been passed. I will concede that this...
Not on the dates, but when it was passed.
Yes.
To the accountant or whoever.
Yes. And so for that, I would concede that the first two are a much closer issue, and third I don't think is reasonably a close issue, but that's what we would argue, that at least some of them they had been checked out for days.
Following up on Judge Beal's question, weren't these folks involved in an ongoing business relationship? Does that make any difference?
I don't believe so. I don't. There was no. In fact, I think the testimony kind of the testimony of the hotel people was quite the contrary. That no, we didn't have any deals. We didn't have anything else. There was no sort of contract, anything like that. I think their testimony kind of went the other way. That may have been the argument of the defendant, which was rejected by the trial court and was against the testimony of the hotel people.
So really, the fact that his testimony that he was going to try to make it up. You know, they just needed to work with me, and they, you know, I talked with the owner, and he was going to let me have another event there so I could pay these off, that sort of thing.
We
that
were
rejected.
Clearly, the trial court rejected that because otherwise it would have been, I gave him a check that I told him was no good and would also not have been a crime. I think it was clearly rejected, and as especially.
Well, Judge O'Brien's question, if I mean, they did testify he was an ongoing vendor there with them.
Yes, Your Honor.
He had events there over a period of time, and he would pay on them over a period of time. But I guess, is your argument essentially that had his argument prevailed on that point in the trial court, he might be in a worse shape now?
Perhaps, Your Honor. I would argue I'm an ongoing business partner with my credit card. I repeatedly make charges, and you know that doesn't mean that by the time my bill arrives that it's not a past debt. We don't have any sort of other type of arrangement, and I would say that this is similar.
Does the record even reflect exactly what this check was in payment for? Whether it was payment for rooms, whether it's payment for liquor or food or the ballroom facilities?
I believe it does. I believe that the Commonwealth entered the statements of account for those purposes, and so that it is on the record.
I mean, it's interesting when you look at the, I can't remember, I think it's Exhibit 8, but the last account statement, and it shows an ending balance of $893.54. You know what I'm referring to there?
Yes, Your Honor.
How could it be $893.54 unless he's been paying on it all along? That was one question I had.
Well, Your Honor, I would argue that if he's made prior payments, then that absolutely certainly at the time he makes the last check makes it a past debt, not something that's being given for present consideration.
But the $893.54 doesn't include those last checks, does it? Because they gave him credit and then they backed it out because the checks were returned for insufficient funds. But the very last, on page 122 of the appendix, it says ending balance. It says previous balance zero. Payments $10,765, new charges $10,469, taxes and services, then ending balance of $893. Maybe that ending balance is, I don't know, at a different time, or did he pay some of this after this all happened? My impression was from both briefs was that he did not pay any more on it.
Subsequent to the checking,
checks were returned.
I don't believe he made any payments after the bad checks were passed. That's my memory of the record.
Okay, yeah, maybe I'm just looking at the wrong thing, but I couldn't reconcile the $893.54 with your argument or with the Commonwealth.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I mean, I think the $893 is just kind of a running total because that statement of account remains open. So if you make a payment that is not a payment in full, there will remain a balance. And I believe that's probably what happened in this case. But we would just argue on the point of the three checks that certainly the one was given months after and that the other two, we would argue, were the same.
Going back to my question, for instance, this, the same statement that we're looking at, and this is the Walton's homecoming event, I think, at page 120 in the appendix. There's a lot of charges on there. And I can't tell exactly what that check that was ultimately given on May 28th of 2015, what that covered.
Well,
we've got
I'm not certain that it matters.
I see a check in January of 2015, which is, I guess, an advance payment. And then we've got a bunch of charges in February and March. But if you add those charges up, they're well in excess of the.
Well, there are also some chargebacks for commissions and other things. I think the thing that's important is that the last charge that is on this statement of account is the 3rd of March, and so it can't have been for any consideration that happened after the 3rd of March. So I think the last, whatever that check is for, we know it is something that happened on the 3rd of March or before. So in May, I would argue that there's not a reasonable argument that is present consideration rather than a past debt.
And I found the testimony very confusing as to even when the checks were received by the hotel. Is there any definitive testimony in there to establish exactly when these other checks were delivered?
Well, I believe that the accountant testified that they would have been posted to the account at the time that they were delivered. That was their.
I thought he said no. I would, if he told me to hold them, I would have held them several days. And he told me, I can't remember if he told me that, but if he did, I would have. And that was your client's testimony. Hold them at least until Monday or something like that, right?
Yes, that was my client's testimony. I would argue again that the court disbelieved that, and certainly I would argue that doesn't come into play on the third check, because if he held it for a month and a half, it still wouldn't have mattered.
All right, Mr. O'Gear, I'm gonna leave you with your rebuttal time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Urban.
May it please the Court, David Uberman on behalf of the Commonwealth. With respect to the procedural issue that the Court identified, Code Section 8.01-271.1 provides that if a written motion is not signed by a counsel of record, that it will be stricken unless it is immediately remedied. In this instance, defense counsel at trial failed to renew his motion to strike at the conclusion of the Commonwealth's rebuttal evidence. On page 65 of the appendix, the Court asks, are there any additional motions after the rebuttal evidence is presented? Counsel says no. So as the Court properly noted before, it appears that the defendant was the one paying attention and attempted to preserve the issue by filing the motion to set aside the verdict.
But I think Mr. Orguera's argument is that would be well and good, except the trial court did, in fact, act on the motion. It didn't strike it.
I understand that, Your Honor, and I don't think it necessarily changes the effect that the code statute has on it. It's true that the trial court ruled on it, but it doesn't change the fact that written motion was not signed by counsel. It's not an issue in this case of notice to the Commonwealth or notice to the court. Rather, it's simply a procedural requirement. Did the defense attorney sign the actual motion to set aside the verdict? And in United Leasing Corp versus Lehner Family Business Trust, which is a Virginia Supreme Court opinion from 2010, did want to note that case expressly applied the Civil Code Section 801-271 to criminal matters, so that it would be applicable in this type of situation.
Can you give me that case again, please?
Yes, sir. It is United Leasing Corporation versus Lehner, Lehner, Family Business Trust.
2010. Okay.
2010. It's 279 VA.
I think Sylvester versus Commonwealth also. No, I'm sorry. That was the, that was.
And 510, 518 was the pinpoint, Your Honor.
510, 518.
And for example, to distinguish the case, the appellant relies upon, for example, Chilton, which is a 2001 decision from this court, which is unpublished. The facts there were different. While the motion in that case was unsigned by counsel and it was submitted pro se, the court permitted it, but the court expressly noted that the evidence at the final hearing indicated that Chilton and his appointed attorney had such serious differences that the trial judge appointed a new attorney. So in such circumstances, the pro se motion sufficiently fulfilled the requirement of Rule 5A18. In this case, there is no such evidence here, and the Commonwealth would argue that appellant's attempt, while certainly in good faith, I understand that Mr. Orguera did as much as he could by filing the motion to supplement the record upon notice that the lower the motion was not signed at the lower court, but that's insufficient, that under Rule 5A, 7A, the record in this court is what is contained in the circuit court. So that document in the circuit court is unsigned by counsel. Even if this court were to accept the signed document into the appellate record here, it nevertheless fails to change that the trial court record remains unsigned.
How do you respond to Mr. O'Hara's argument? Well, as soon as it was brought to counsel's attention, I tried to sign it. I tried to correct it.
And again, I certainly can't fault him for that, but we're well beyond Rule 1:1 at that point in time. The trial court, at that point, it was
so
literally.
The argument is it would have had to have been corrected while it was in the bosom of the trial court.
Yes,
court
or at
this court.
Yes, sir, or at least not a week before, oral argument, not subsequent to the actual grant of the case. That at this stage in the proceeding, when the case is clearly before this appellate court, that at that point
would
it was simply untimely.
The new rule, 5A, was it 10A, whatever, that we were just referring to?
5A, 7A.
5A, 7A.
Yes, sir.
Does that, which became effective August 1,
mm-hmm.
would that change anything if it were in effect at that point?
I suppose it could, Your Honor, and I don't recall what its predecessor required, but I do believe a recollection serves argument to this court previously that the record before this court is what was contained in the trial court, and I apologize that I don't have a specific cite to that specific rule, but I don't think that necessarily Rule 5A, 7A is a new rule of law. It may be a separate codified or a newly reenacted portion of it, but my understanding was that the trial court record is always been considered what was submitted to the circuit court below. For example, as recently in April of this year, in 2017, this court held in Beatty versus Beatty, again, which is an unpublished opinion, if it wasn't in the appendix, that the court wouldn't consider it. And there it was a transcript.
I'm referring to 1:5A. I'm sorry, I had to find it. That became effective August 1st.
Oh, yes, sir, with respect to the signature requirements.
Right, that you can cure defective signatures. But I guess my question is, would it apply in this situation where it's now in a different court?
My response is no, Your Honor, not at this point in time, because it did not control it at the time where the defect could have been cured in the circuit court. At the point where it became effective, it was here. And in any event, it remains the Commonwealth's argument that at the point when appellate counsel attempted to cure the defect, it was nevertheless still untimely, although recognizing it was the best he could do with what he had.
Can I ask you a question on the merits on
yes.
this?
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
On the first two checks, the ones that were dated April 18th and April 20th, the accountant testifies that they were received, I can't put my finger on the exact page right now, Travis Cosell testifies that they were received, oh yeah, I do have it, page 37 of the appendix.
Yes, sir.
Do you know when you accepted the checks? After the events was his answer.
Yes, sir.
How do you, the Commonwealth respond to that?
Two ways, Your Honor. One, of course, the court's aware that the checks are dated April 18th, April 20th. But we don't have just Mr. Cosell's testimony in this case. We also have the defendant's testimony, and he testified that he provided the checks to the hotel on Fridays before the events. That's on page 44 of the appendix. And the evidence bears that out. He says, I provided them on a Friday. I asked them to wait until Monday to deposit them. April 18th and April 20th conform to those dates. The date or the event, rather, is identified in the invoice as something called Dead End Con, and there are clearly numerous food and beverage charges on the account, and there were guests staying in the hotel up and through the 20th of April.
Let me ask you about that. I find it interesting that the statute uses the term present consideration, which in my mind envisions a kind of simultaneous transaction, which is what we normally think of when somebody purchases something at a store, receives something, gives a bad check. It's understandable how the General Assembly can say, well, that's just the same as stealing. It doesn't use past consideration, and it doesn't use future consideration. What you're talking about seems to be in the nature of future consideration.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree with respect to the first two checks. With respect to the first two checks, they were presented to the hotel as the event was ongoing, those April 18th and April 20th. The Commonwealth recognizes that it's a tougher sell with respect to the third check, number 1130, that applied to the Walton homecoming.
You're saying because it was given on the Friday prior to the weekend event?
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'll try to artfully state this. The event was held Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Mr. McGinnis, the defendant, testified that he provided the checks to the hotel on a Friday. April 18th was, in fact, a Friday.
Not the Friday before the events.
Friday of the events, yes, sir. And Mr. Cosell, as the court has noted, testified that he received them after the events. But again, that's conflicted with Mr. McGinnis' own testimony.
If you look at the charges on there, you know, some of those charges occur after that Friday, don't they?
Yes, sir, they do.
So how can we say this is present consideration when some of the charges hadn't even occurred yet?
Well, Your Honor, my understanding from the testimony, both from the hotel staff, the director of the hotel's accountant, and Mr. McGinnis himself, is that they had this ongoing business relationship, that he was a vendor for the hotel, that he would collect payment before the events from those attending the events and then provide a check to the hotel itself to pay for those events.
It seems to me that the General Assembly has enacted a specific statute to deal with this situation, 18.2-188, defrauding a hotel. And I would think that was enacted because of the difficulties in the present consideration discussion of the 18.2-111 bad check statute.
Mm-hmm. It may have been, Your Honor, and I can see in this case that Mr. McGinnis was charged under 18.2-181. And
is the Code of Virginia getting hard to find by lawyers nowadays? What about that third check? Is there any? I mean, isn't that clearly a past debt, payment for a past debt?
It is a past debt, Your Honor. And the Commonwealth's position is that this court in Sylvester, when interpreting the term present consideration for goods and services, you know, as the court knows, that term was amended in 1978 by the General Assembly in response to a 1977 opinion of the Virginia Supreme Court, which held that goods or rather services cannot be the subject of the crime of larceny because of common law they could not be taken and carried away. So the General Assembly changed numerous statutes to be consistent with the times. This court in Sylvester noted that, as held in Bray, the amendment did not make it the crime of larceny to give a bad check as payment for past debt or gifts, but it also noted that nor did the amendment alter or limit the scope of the first paragraph as it existed prior to 1978. And while the Commonwealth concedes that it's persuasive authority, there's also an opinion of the Attorney General that's cited in Sylvester that states that the 1978 amendment to that specific code section addresses itself to a narrowly drawn factual situation. And importantly, it states it does not negate the language contained in the first paragraph of the section, which always allows the prosecution of any person who issues bad checks with the intent to defraud. And it's the Commonwealth's position that in this case, when Mr. McGinnis issued the check with respect to the Walton homecoming in May, he was aware that he had insufficient funds.
Let me stop you there.
Yes, sir.
Are you just reading out the present consideration portion of the statute?
No, Your Honor. I apologize. I was citing the Sylvester Court, which was citing an opinion of the Attorney General.
But that dealt with the inclusion of services in what can be stolen.
Correct, Your Honor, but it also did note that first paragraph of Code Section 18.2-181 remained in full effect, even with the addition of that final paragraph, and that's the point that I was trying to convey. In Bray, for example, the facts there were that the defendant made a prospective payment. She paid in a security deposit for a residential property on a check that she knew had since been, the account for which had since been closed. And she argued, much like McGinnis does in this case, that she could not be convicted because the check was not present consideration for goods or services received because it was prospectively paid. This court in Bray disagreed and expressly found that the gravamen of the offense under 18.2-181 is the intent to defraud, and stated, quote, "The offense is complete when, with the intent to defraud, a person makes or draws or utters a check he knows to be worthless," unquote. And the record in this case demonstrated that Mr. McGinnis was aware at the time he made the payment in May that his check, his balance had insufficient funds to cover the check that he was writing. But the Commonwealth does not contend that it was a past debt. That's an untenable position.
So is it your position it doesn't matter whether it was a past debt or not?
It's the Commonwealth's position, Your Honor, that given the scope of the first paragraph of Code Section 18.2-181, that a conviction can nevertheless be supported when it's made under these circumstances, provided that it's done with knowledge that there are insufficient funds and with the intent to defraud.
Well, those are always elements of the offense.
Yes, sir, Your Honor.
So what I'm hearing is that you're asking us to just ignore the present consideration and say that as long as is an attempt at a fraud and knowledge of insufficient funds, that's all it takes to support a conviction.
I'm asking the court to find similarly as they did in Bray, in that there, again, it was a prospective payment, and the court expressly found that it did not have to be present consideration.
But isn't that sort of future consideration, if you will, something paid now for you to do something later, whereas here we're looking at just paying a past debt, aren't we?
Yes, Your Honor.
Isn't that different?
It is. It's and the Commonwealth's position, again, is simply that the first paragraph remains in full effect.
But your argument on the first two checks, April 18th and 20th, is that appellant here testified that he gave them to him that Friday, that was when the conference was ongoing. Just beginning, but ongoing. And so it's not a past debt on those two.
Correct, Your Honor, that they were made contemporaneously with the event itself, that Mr. McGinnis testifies that he handed them to who he identifies as a sales representative named Austin on page 44 of the appendix.
So ironically, the argument of the Commonwealth is that we need to take the evidence in light most favorable to the Commonwealth because the Commonwealth prevailed below, and so we need to take defendant's testimony over the accountant's testimony.
Well, Your Honor, I think the trial court was in the best situation to view the demeanor.
The trial court was never presented the question, and that's the whole problem.
Understood, Your Honor, but the trial court did hear the testimony of Mr. McGinnis, and that evidence was in front of the trial court, and it was permitted to consider it and give weight to it as it deemed fit. It may have rejected portions of his testimony as self-serving, but he essentially conceded and made an admission on the record when he said, I provided these checks to the hotel on the Friday of Dead End Con and, you know, asked that they be cashed on Monday. And again, the dates of those checks are April 18, 2015, April 20th, 2015. Dead End Con, for lack of a better term, that this was called, ran from April 18th through the 20th. So, you can be seen on pages 116 to 118 of the appendix. It's clear that that account incurred charges for food, beverages, in addition to services in the form of hotel rooms. Unless there are any additional questions from the court, I'll rest on the remainder of the argument set forth on brief.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Orgeri, you have your remaining 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just briefly to touch on the issue of when the order would have to be corrected, we would kind of argue that, you know, what's good for the goose is also good for the gander, that if the order had to be signed to be corrected while it was in the bosom of the trial court, that it also had to be stricken while it was in the bosom of the trial court. And we would argue that that void versus voidable comes into play here, and that if anything, this order is voidable rather than void ab initio. And rule, I think it's 1.1, says that if an order is voidable,
you're talking about his January 19th order.
Yes, Your
denying
Honor.
Denying the motion.
Yes, Your Honor. And if that rule is just voidable, it may only be voided on motion of the party and may not be addressed sua sponte by this court, whereas if it is void ab initio, it may be addressed sua sponte by this court. And we would argue that the judge clearly had jurisdiction.
But the problem with that is then how is it preserved? Why don't we have a Rule 518 problem if it's
Well, I would argue that past precedence says that we don't. Additionally, as far as the 5A18, I would argue that we can kind of even flip that, because I think this is one of the rare instances that had this been raised by the Commonwealth at any point, we would have been arguing 5A18, because I believe there was both good cause and ends of justice reasons to do this. The good cause is that the defendant did it. He was unhappy with counsel, and he did it the right way. He even served counsel. We would argue that that is good cause shown, and additionally, we would argue the ends of justice. The standard seems to be at this point that the record has to affirmatively prove that no crime was committed, and we would argue that with the record that we have, that record proves that these, certainly one, and we would argue the other two, are past debts, and that's what these checks were given for. And so even if we have a problem with the statute and the signature, we would argue that this is one of those rare occasions that satisfies both the good cause shown and the ends of justice exception to 5A18, because everything we need is on the record, and it affirmatively proves past debt, and therefore not.
Don't you agree, though, on two of those checks, the evidence is not quite that clear?
I would concede that the evidence is not as clear as the third one, and I think that's about as far as I can go.
As a matter of fact, this may be a case where the Commonwealth could have proven it if the Commonwealth had understood it had to prove it.
I understand that, but the record is what it is, and our argument would be that the evidence is sufficient.
But for ends of justice, we have to be able to look at the record and say that the element of the offense never occurred.
And I believe that
the Commonwealth failed to prove it.
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe that the affirmative statement that the checks were taken before after the events, and the statements that shows when the charges were made and when the checks were given, does that. That would be our position.
Some evidence, as the Commonwealth argued, that the checks were given, the first two checks were given during the event.
I think the court had to necessarily reject that, because his whole statement was, I gave him these ahead of time and told them that they were no good. And under Virginia law, if you accept that, that's also not a violation of the statute.
Was that an argument ever presented to the trial court?
Yes, it was, Your Honor.
Okay.
Finally, abuse of discretion. All of the court cases I've seen on this statute all rely on a review standard of abuse of discretion by the trial court, and we would argue that the fact that the trial court, that the application of the statute is reviewed as an abuse of discretion standard, and we would argue that the fact that the trial court chose to review the motion and dismiss it, deny it rather, shows that he because he's expected to do what is proper and assumed to do what is proper and know the law, that he looked at the situation and in his discretion he found that under these circumstances it was proper to do so.
All right. Thank you very much for your argument. We will greet counsel.